Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
So, how many hours a day would you say you spend listening to the police scanner?
That is a really hard question to answer, because in some ways I just turn it on when I start my day and I fall asleep sometimes still listening. But a lot of times in the middle of the day, I go with that. And there have been full days like yesterday where I just never tune in.
Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect on KPLU, and I'm at a co-working space in the Capitol Hill neighborhood with Justin Carter, who's the founder and publisher of Capitol Hill Seattle Blog. And we're talking about one of the mainstays of his sort of work day. And I don't know, would you call yourself a hobbyist?
Oh, definitely not. This is all about pros, right? I mean, as pro as I get. You ever see the scene in Batman where he's got all the technology and he's looking at the screen and listening to the city? I'm like that, only with the worst possible technology you can imagine, jerry-rigged together. It's a chance to kind of listen in on a conversation that's happening around the important things in this neighborhood.
So what we're talking about, of course, is the police scanner, or I guess emergency response scanner signal, which means you can kind of listen in on their radio chatter. Can you think of some examples of some of the more interesting or dramatic or memorable things that you've heard on the scanner?
The fire at Neighbors, was it 2 years ago now, where hundreds of people could have been caught in a burning nightclub, and fortunately nobody was seriously hurt. In the summertime especially, we get all sorts of phone calls, texts about fireworks because they're scary to people. They hear a big boom, they want to know if it's gunshots.
Got multiple people calling in again reporting shots, 500 block Boylston, another person, 14 of Mercer. 911 has spiked with approximately 20 callers. Is it still fireworks as far as we know?
Edward 21, A-Firm, is still fireworks.
Copy, thank you.
The cops think that they're gunfire sometimes too, and I've heard other officers give the cop a hard time and make fun of them for freaking out over fireworks like a newbie.
And so you never go get coffee with Tracy Record and somebody from the PI and talk scanner turkey?
No, not really. You know, it is funny. I think there's a little bit of there's shame in the scanner in journalism. There's a sense of that it's not real reporting. So I think it's still, it's not something we talk about.
Why is there that cultural reticence to use the scanner in journalism? I mean, journalists have so little shame.
Well, I mean, I do think that there's been some massive mistakes in reporting that have been made because of them. It's more than the fog of war. You're literally not there, and you're listening to voices, and police can be wrong also. You know, you're depending on their observations or the things that they're saying.
So it's a tradition to not necessarily base your reporting on it.
Yeah, it's a tradition, and it's a tradition that is shifting. And sadly, one of the things that has really shifted it on the national stage has been the proliferation of mass shootings. There's not much information in those early minutes other than scanners.
Does it give you a different kind of understanding of what the job of being a public safety professional is all about?
Definitely. Yeah, I feel a high degree of empathy from hearing these voices all the time. You start to kind of recognize some of them. You definitely get a sense of some of them who just seem like they're better at their job. You feel sorry for some of them that you can tell are miscast and unhappy. And how much of their daily work is to deal with things that are important but that they're not ready or equipped to deal with, like people who are having mental crisis and those kinds of things. So on that front too, it gives you a real appreciation for how much of their day is just filled with things that they're the only one around to deal with.
Well, eavesdropping has a pretty deep allure for so many of us, and that's the theme of our show today here on Sound Effect. We're going to have stories of eavesdropping from all over the region, so hey, don't go away. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
First up, we have a story about eavesdropping on some of the most chilling moments in a person's life. For this, we head up to Anacortes, Washington. The little coastal town has a vibrant and tight-knit independent music scene, and Carl Blau has long been close to the center of it. He's put out more than 30 albums over the last couple of decades. His latest project is actually a place, an all-ages music venue that grew into an online radio station called the Anacortes Music Channel. It was housed in a beautiful old downtown brick building.
The thing that's beautiful about this space is the tall ceilings. It's got almost 17-foot ceilings, and so it feels just really big.
The Anacortes Music Channel became a focal point for local musicians and fans in this little town, long known more for its industrial past. And for Carl, it became a lifeline. But one night, all that changed.
On Tuesday the 8th of December, the night began with a Ben Starner piano performance, which was beautiful. I was here for the first hour of it. And we were airing this on the Anacortes Music Channel. And the place was just decked out. I mean, it was so ornate and beautiful. Jacques Moderet, who's a neighbor of the place, and he's this amazing artist, and had installed this Where the Wild Things Are-esque forest of plastic trees and silk flowers and Indonesian masks. And it was packed full of these beautiful trees, and we'd been doing these performances kind of in a forest. It was really fun. During the Ben Starner concert, I left to go do dishes and kind of clean up home like I do, and then I was like, okay, I'm gonna come back, you know, as soon as the concert's over. Ben would perform, and then he would just leave and lock the place.
Doug Cassidy, I'm from Anacortes. So I stayed home that night, and I was listening to Ben play on the live stream, and just going about my business, doing this and that at home, and I start to hear what sounds to me like raindrops. At first, I thought that Carl had brought a microphone outside and was pointing it at a bucket of water or something like that. And
was that something he would do?
Yeah, and everyone I've told the story to at this point, they say, oh, well, yeah, of course, that's Carl would do that, sure. And so, you know, after a couple minutes of this, I started getting a weird feeling about it, and the drops started getting louder and louder, and I started thinking that they didn't really sound like raindrops anymore. Now they started to sound like something popping. It wasn't really like a campfire, because it was just more like pop, 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 pop.
You know, driving up on the scene, I just immediately knew something was horribly wrong, because the glass was black, couldn't see into the room at all. Usually you can see, at least see in, and it was just this total other feeling walking up to it, like it was a different dimension. And it took me a couple moments to just suddenly realize the reality that it was actually full of smoke. When I came into the room, you know, this plastic forest was melted, and the place was just thick with black smoke. I don't remember exactly the smell, just a really plasticky smell, and my inside of my nose was just caked.
Right about the time where I started thinking something was wrong down there, I hear the door open, and I hear Carl shout something as he comes in the door and into the flaming building.
It was really horrific to watch this kind of paradise of my mind be just engulfed and feel so helpless. My instinct was to try to tackle the fire, which was in the back corner there. And I could see the carpet was really a main source of the flames. And I attempted to drag the carpet out, which the piano was on top of, and in some kind of Herculean moment, I pulled the carpet so hard the piano actually fell back.
Help! Help!
Onto the microphones that were recording. One of them cut out, I guess, and then one of them kept broadcasting the situation. And then I was like coughing, and I realized that there was just nothing I could do. And also realized I did not have my cell phone with me. One of the strange, rare moments that I decided not to, you know, have a cell phone with me. And there's no one around down here. It's dead.
You know, I had the phone in my hand kind of already at that point. And so I called 911 then, and then headed down here.
Then I realized at that moment that Rick and Bev are upstairs, and you know, and then that suddenly occurred to me that I don't know how fast this can go up. Then next thing I was like, oh my God, I gotta get this guy's out. And I ended up smashing the window with my elbow and breaking into their apartment and screaming as I'm running up the stairs. And then I couldn't do really much else but just kind of stand outside and kind of freak out and just wonder why it's taking so long for the fire department to show up when it was probably like 2 minutes or something. I don't know how long.
What was it like to hear, overhear this very scary moment for your friend on the internet?
Well, it was just the feeling of knowing something was wrong and then having it confirmed. That was the scary part, was that at first I thought it was Carl messing around, and then it turns out to be our fun all-ages space getting burned down. And just right at the moment when Carl walked in and shouted something, I was just really kind of devastated for our scene, because, you know, we had a great thing going for almost a year of really awesome shows and jams, and, you know, it was heartbreaking.
The hardest thing for me is that I lost 20 years of magnetic tapes that I'd been working on things for the years. I mean, just hundreds of tapes. It was a real blow to me. Like, it was depressing, of course. And I thought, well, I can just keep feeling depressed, or I can, you know, I have spent a year working on other people's things, using all my extra energy to float this space. So I was like, yeah, I'm gonna take all of these ideas, you know, that are on my phone or whatever, and just start working them out. And so I've been doing that, yeah, and I'm like 10 songs deep into that. The process has really been to mine emotions of loss, and but the hope is kind of pulling me through creating these songs. The hope that was sort of instilled by the community and the support. I don't know, I didn't see this coming, that it would be such a rally. You know, there were a lot of Seattle and Northwest support, and friends and supporters in Anacortes too raised, I don't know, like $25,000 or something for my loss, which, yeah, that's pretty incredible. I listened back to that footage one time late at night as a kind of a self dare. I was like, can you do it? And I probably shouldn't have done it right before bed, because it was, yeah, I don't probably never want to do that again, at least not for the whole thing. It really, it got under my skin. It took me back when I saw this paradise of a room just black with smoke. I think something just flipped inside of me that yeah, when I listened back to the tapes, I felt like I still was holding on to it. Like I haven't really dealt with it. I think now it would be a little easier. I think I've been processing enough with writing music and thinking about it and talking to people about it and stuff, that it's probably easier now.
That was Anacortes musician Carl Blau and his friend Doug Cassidy. They spoke with sound effect producer Ali Ferguson. Officials still don't know what exactly caused the fire, but the space has been refurbished now, and it's home to longtime Anacortes record store, The Business. The Anacortes Music Channel is homeless for the time being, but still supporting local music. This is Sound Effect from KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're telling stories of eavesdropping. In the TMI culture of social media, you can wind up listening in on some pretty personal stuff, and sometimes it's hard to know what to make of it. I think a lot of us have had the experience of reading what seems like a pretty distressing post on Facebook, someone who seems like they're in a bad place emotionally and might need someone to intervene. Or maybe not. Maybe they're just being a little dramatic, or maybe they're quoting song lyrics or something. Often it feels like the safest thing to do is just ignore it. This group, Forefront, does suicide prevention work out of the University of Washington, and they're working to educate people on how to recognize when a friend really does need a hand. And they're building tools for people who find themselves overhearing somebody's cry for help on social media. Stephen Paul Miller is operations manager at Forefront, and he told us about something that happened to him right after he started there.
I was doing spreadsheets and grant applications and all these other kind of infrastructure type things, but I managed our phone and our emails, and every time someone like Robin Williams died, I get these calls from people, and I'm like in the middle of like, you know, managing tabs in a spreadsheet to like instantly going into somebody's painful moments of I don't want to live or this is too much. We're certainly not a crisis line, but sometimes it doesn't matter because if people think of suicide and know that you work in suicide, they'll call you.
Did you feel ready for that?
No, absolutely not. The first time somebody called, it was as an intern, and I answered the phone, and this person told me that he wanted to end his life. And I like said, can you please hold? And I was like freaking out, panicked, handed it to Sue Eastgard, and I saw her basically get this guy to care. That was really inspiring for me.
What do you think you were missing that made you unable to handle that on your own, besides the fact that you were just panic. An intern?
Yeah. Well, the panic and the fact that like we don't understand suicide. I mean, think about in the 80s with HIV. It's like you say it and everybody freaks out. And there's the general population hasn't caught up with the field. A lot of these suicides are preventable. There are these steps that you can take to help somebody in those moments. And you just don't get that. When you don't know how to handle something, when you don't know how to help someone, it's really frightening.
Is that something that has come up for you before you had those directions on how to interact with this?
You know, I will never forget the day I got home from work. It was like 9:30 at night, something like that, and I was checking Facebook on my BlackBerry, and I saw this post that from a classmate friend, and I remember feeling in my stomach that something wasn't right about that post.
Do you remember what it was that jumped out at you?
Now, as a trainer, I know that you're always looking for change, and my friend was the one who was like most encouraging of me, was somebody who every time he saw me, he asked me how my application to college was. Did I get in? You're gonna get in, don't worry. So to go from that kind of like just absolute support to like, I can't take it anymore, this is too much, that something's off. There's this moment of decision of like, do I message him? Do I message somebody else? And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to call him tomorrow. I'm going to get a hold of him tomorrow. And he died that night. The only person that responded to that post said, oh, you're being so dramatic. That was the only response. If that hadn't happened, would it have been different? If somebody had said, we love you, hang in there, like, would it have been different?
So I know that Forefront has done some work on a kind of like some technological tools around this. Can you talk about that?
Well, actually, Facebook came to us saying, hey, we connect people. And sometimes that's over lasagna and the new puppy I got. And sometimes that's, hey, I want to end my life because it's too hard. So what Facebook and Forefront have created is you can report the post, you can get resources to the person who you're concerned about, you can get resources as the reporter, like here's some things to talk about, here's the lifeline, you can connect to other friends who can then reach out, because we know that connection's really important in those moments.
Have you heard anything about the way people are using it?
I've used it. I had a friend, another classmate of mine who was posting some nostalgic photos and had gone through something, and then post, tomorrow is a day that never comes. And I was like, no, no, no. Reported the post, went through the entire sequence. And he was like, no, man, sorry. I was just had a breakup and this is happening. And you know what though? He messaged me privately and was like, dude, thank you so much for the concern and for reaching out. I'm good. But I really appreciate that.
So you talked about having had your own struggles with thoughts of suicide, are there things you want to say about that?
It was really difficult for me to try to figure out how to work, how to pay for school, how to be a positive human being, how to, you know, grow. And I remember going back down to Portland and my parents had been divorced. You know, we grew up pretty poor. There was this really big deal where we remodeled our house. It's the first time we had ever had any money to do anything. I mean, we bought new furniture and like had our house painted and new carpet. And it was kind of like a pretty big deal for us and our family. And I remember going down to visit for Easter, and it was the first time I had been to my mom's apartment after the divorce, and I saw we had purchased as a family this like furniture piece, the set, you know, the table, the end tables, etc. And I was at my mom's apartment and I saw just the end table.
Oh, separated from all the rest.
Separated. And it was just like, that was like one of the more devastating things. I just felt so out of control and just ruptured family and identity. And I remember my mom went to sleep and I like grabbed the keys to her car and I just thought, I could probably just crash this car right now and then maybe that would solve something. And I remember calling my friend Derek and I was like, dude, I just can't do this. This is too much. And he like heard me and he was like, you have to. It was sweet and it was vulnerable and it was supportive and I knew I had somebody I could talk to. And I'm glad he answered that phone. Let's just say that.
So having been on the other, you know, both sides of that phone call now, what difference does it make to have a clear set of instructions?
I remember somebody calling saying that they wanted to end their life. They wanted to end their life just like their son did. And I remember taking a deep breath and just sitting with her in that grief. Those things that I train people to do, I was able to hold on to. And it was pretty quick. 10 minutes went from I want to die to I don't want to die. It just hurts so dang much. And thank you for connecting me to care. Like, that's wow. Wow, to be able to offer that to somebody in that type of experience, I mean, it's something sacred, really.
Well, Stephen, before we go, for anybody who's listening to this who feels like they need to reach out to somebody, where should they go?
They should go to the crisis clinic or to the National Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK.
And we'll put some more resources up on our website at kplusoundeffect.org. And Stephen Paul Miller is operations manager at Forefront, which is a suicide prevention group based out of the University of Washington. Thank you very much for being on our show, Stephen.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is eavesdropping. Deep down on the seafloor off the coast of Alaska, there are about a dozen big, heavy, old train wheels. They anchor a series of underwater microphones.
I mean, you can hear earthquakes and volcanoes, you can hear ships, you can hear wind and waves, and you can hear fish and seals and whales and anything that produces sound underwater. You can eavesdrop essentially on the ocean 24 hours a day, whether it's light outside or dark, whether there's a storm raging or not.
That's University of Washington oceanographer Kate Stafford. She listens back to those recordings with the help of some high-tech software to decode what's happening down in the depths. And she's especially interested in one of the noisiest creatures, whales.
So some of the questions that you can answer with these data are you can look at migratory patterns of animals over very, very long distances. For instance, we've found that blue whales in the Northeast Pacific make a very specific sound. It's called the A-B song because we acousticians are extraordinarily clever.
Is that something you can give us a flavor of?
Sure, but I'll do it sped up. So the A sound would be something like bum 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 bum, and that's sped up about 20 times. So this is a signal that can last over a minute. And we've recorded it all the way from the Gulf of Alaska down to the eastern tropical Pacific. We've been able to look at the migratory pattern of this population of blue whales and define them as a population of blue whales.
And that's important. I mean, it may seem self-evident, but why is it important to know what their movements are?
If you're interested in conservation of species, so the idea really is to move these animals off the endangered species list. But to do so, we need to understand what their population structure is, what their habitat range is, what their critical habitat is. And acoustic data can let us do a lot of this.
So we know that these creatures communicate in some way to each other. What does it have in common with language, and how is it different from what we know?
Boy, that's a really good question, and I would say that the science has not caught up with that yet. I mean, language serves a purpose in order to communicate something. So these sounds are not produced by accident. They're produced purposefully, which means they have to be communicating something. Whether that's, I'm over here, or I'm your mom, or I'm the biggest, most reproductively successful guy you're ever going to meet. We don't know. We can only hypothesize.
Can you ever recognize individuals?
I can't from my data. I do some work up in the Pacific Arctic up off of Barrow, where I'll put a dipping hydrophone, which is just a microphone on a string, into the water. And we can see the whales going by, but the animal that surfaces, you can't be certain that that's the animal that made the sounds.
That's got to be kind of cool.
It is really cool.
I mean, because then you're really close, right? I mean, it must be a different kind of interaction.
Yeah, you're very, very close. You almost want to dip your head underwater and...
and do what? What would you do?
Just say hi. Listen. Yeah, or just see what it's like to be swimming around under there with all that noise and all the ice.
What's something that you've learned, a new insight that you gained from that work up around Alaska?
Well, there's a couple things. One is I do some monitoring in an area called the Bering Strait, which is the pinch point between Russia and the United States. And what we found listening to some of our hydrophone data is that we're getting more subarctic or summer whales there in the summer and even into the late fall. And we suspect that hearing these animals is a result of seasonal sea ice decreasing. So essentially the habitat that's available to them is increasing.
So as the earth warms, they can range farther.
Yep.
Is that stressful for them or is that good for them?
Well, it's probably good for them. I mean, they're going there because presumably it's good habitat with a lot of good food.
A lot of people use whale song to like fall asleep, or they listen to it. They think it has some kind of a new age sort of a, you know, resonance or who knows. But people imbue it with some kind of spiritual kind of a meaning. And I was just curious what you make of that.
I think they haven't listened to very much whale song because I love listening to it, but sometimes it sounds like fingers on a blackboard.
Oh, really? Sometimes it's not pretty.
No. No, especially not the bowhead whales. And humpback whales, both of these species sing. You know, humpback whales mainly are funny to me. I mean, they make these, since we're being non-scientific, very farty sounds and funny little whoops. But it's not peaceful. It's really cool, but it's nothing I'd want to fall asleep to.
And what about with the bowheads?
The bowheads is similar. They tend to be a little less structured than humpback whale songs, but when a bowhead starts to sing, you can tell they're putting their whole heart and body into it, and they are shouting. Crazy, crazy sounds.
Is there another big mystery that you're hoping to unlock?
So one of the things that I'm a little bit obsessed with right now is... So humpback whales are probably the best known singer. All of the males sing the same song every year. Now, the song changes throughout the year, but everybody changes it and everybody sings the same song. And the song is different from one year to the next, but the point is that everybody's humming the same tune. With bowhead whales, on the other hand, they sing many, many, many different songs per year. And from one year to the next, they're all completely different again. And we don't know if each individual has their own song, or if a cohort of whales has the same song and shares that. And so what I'm really curious about is why? What is the biological reason for changing your song all the time? You can tell a bowhead whale song is a bowhead whale song. It's kind of like telling maybe jazz from country. But within that venue, the songs are so, so different. And I'd love to know why.
Do you like listening to it?
I love listening to it. That's the best part of my job.
Why?
Well, because you get this unique perspective underwater. You know, there's this famous Jacques Cousteau movie where he starts out saying, you know, la mer est monde silencieuse, you know, the ocean is a silent world. And yet it's anything but silent. You hear the fish and the whales and the dolphins and the seals all making sounds all at once. And it's this spectacular cacophony that just standing on the ice edge or standing on the shore of the ocean or even being on a boat, you would have no idea it existed. So it's a real privilege to be able to eavesdrop underwater this way, to understand that all this is going on all the time outside of what we see, it's magic.
Well, Kate Stafford is a principal oceanographer in the Applied Physics Lab at the University of Washington, and she joined us today to talk about eavesdropping on whales. The whale wiretap, I call it. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is eavesdropping. And when you think of eavesdropping, you might think about the gumshoe, the private dick, the PI, like these guys.
You're a private eye, huh?
That's right.
I like you to look for somebody.
As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story. But each had the same ending, murder.
Mr. Lloyd, I'm quite sure that Mr. Holmes can be trusted not to fail. He never has, you know.
Thank you, Watson.
I'm nobody's husband. I'm a PI.
We were curious about how real life matches up with the movies, and so we caught up with an actual private investigator who specializes in surveillance. David Liston of David Liston Investigative Services in University Place.
You might find me in some neighborhood trying to be invisible in a vehicle that's masked off so that it looks like there's nobody in it. And I would be staring probably at the same door for several hours.
Sounds thrilling.
It's not at all like you expect on TV. And who would put up with a movie where it's 7 hours of nothing watching for somebody to show up somewhere?
When you're sitting there for hours on end just waiting for something to happen or somebody to turn up, what do you do? How do you keep from going insane? Or actually, more appropriately, how do you keep from falling asleep?
I would say terror really mostly is my prime motivator as far as staying awake goes, and that is the terror of realizing that you missed something, that you had gotten distracted looking at something, and it takes very few seconds for somebody to emerge from someplace and go somewhere if you don't see it.
So when you're sitting there with your sights trained on somebody or some residence or a business or whatever, what are you usually looking for?
The nature of the case will dictate the objective, and that is if it's an L&I claim, a labors and industry claim where our clients suspect that the person we're looking for really can work and is not actually as injured as they claim they are. Usually that's a mobile surveillance where we'll go with the people to a home center and they'll be loading fencing and bricks into a truck.
And is that an actual example?
That actually happened several times.
What's it like when you've been waiting for hours and hours and then somebody finally emerges and you get the goods? You see them lifting the bricks or whatever.
When you see them come out of the driveway or get going, it's a lot of adrenaline and hoping that you don't get cut off in traffic in the first 30 seconds, because that can happen. And especially people who have never lived in the Seattle area that don't know what the traffic is like here can't believe it. They're going, they got away from you? How is that possible? And I'm thinking, well, you should come out of Indiana and come here and just drive here one day.
Could you just walk me through a pretty typical case?
We had picked this subject up at SeaTac Airport when he came in from out of town and followed him to his residence, and then we broke off. And then we resumed the surveillance a few days later. And I had sat on an opposite block from the subject all day. And my time to quit came, and I thought, I might as well sit here. It's 4 o'clock. Southbound I-5 is going to be awful. I might as well just wait out the traffic. And if something happens, then yay, I'm a genius. And so about that time, people started arriving. And then finally, for the first time that day, our subject came out of the house. The same guy that we had followed from SeaTac to his residence came out, and everybody played basketball out in the driveway. So I had a side-on view and was getting video of this. And they played pretty hard for about 45 minutes. And then everybody else left, and he stayed out there doing layups right there in front of me. And I'm just thinking, this is amazing. And so when I called my clients in California and I told them that what had happened, they to this day think that we're just the best investigators ever. And we're just, you know, we were just there.
Do you ever get made? I mean, do you ever get sort of found out by the subject that you're trying to track?
Yes, one time badly. The subject came to the car, opened the front door, and started honking the horn, thinking that I had abandoned the car and I was off in one of the fields, because it's a rural area.
So this person figured out something was up, but didn't see you in the car. Where were you?
I was in the back. with the cloak of invisibility, which was my black coat, over my head, trying to be invisible. And in this instance, it worked. And she's in the front honking the horn, probably thinking I'm off on a field or something. And I think I may have had something like real estate signs on the side of the car. So I'm in their imagination off somewhere, and I've left the car behind. But I'm in the back going, oh my gosh, I didn't lock the doors. Honk, honk, honk. So she went inside. And then pretty soon, here comes the male half out from the house and stalking straight to my car. And now I'm hearing this metallic banging on the car. He's yelling for me to come out and bang, 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 come out of there. After he left and was walking off, I looked out the window and he's got a Browning high power 9mm in his right hand. And I'm thinking, that's what was making the banging noise. So in this instance, though, I couldn't call the police because we're in this valley where there's no cells coverage. So I radioed to my partner, Justin Welter, is off about a quarter mile away. And when you hear him tell the story, I'm screaming hysterically. But really, it sounded more like this. Justin, there's a guy out here with a gun beating on the car. I'd like for you to call the police. It was the only time Justin had ever seen it in 13 years of his surveillance work of anybody bringing a gun out.
Wow.
And it's for me, too.
So there's a kind of mythology of the PI out there making his own rules and all that kind of stuff. And it sounds like the very opposite of that. You're living very much within the rule of law.
More than anybody would suspect. Take one incident depicted on any TV show or any movie about investigators. You wouldn't get past the first 5 minutes before the Department of Licensing would be calling you and saying, you're done. It's impossible. We can't commit felonies. We've had people wanting us to sell drugs or buy drugs from a business that they suspect drug traffic is going on. And it's we don't have any positive defense against that. We're as bad of felons as the people selling or buying it, if we're selling it or buying it.
I wonder if either from your clients or from your surveillance work observing all these subjects, if you've learned something about human nature.
I don't know if my perspective is really very well calibrated anymore. I think it may be a job hazard. You know, it's similar to an EMS job where it probably seems like everybody's getting in car wrecks and getting injured because that's what they see all day. A lot of our clients don't seem to have a really good grasp on reality. They think that the things they see in movies is real. So I'm not sure everybody else is all that well calibrated either. So maybe it's not just me.
Well, shedding a little light on the realities of eavesdropping and surveillance, David Liston is agency principal at Liston Investigative Services, which is based in University Place. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And to wrap up our show on eavesdropping today, we bring you a story about what it's like to listen in to an intimate moment from the past. In 2001, producer Warren Langford discovered a long-forgotten audio artifact, and he got kind of obsessed. After a decade of thinking about this little sonic time capsule, Warren decided he had no choice but to track down its creator.
A year after I graduated high school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, my buddy Liz Prince and I were just aimlessly driving around town. We stop at a yard sale. In a box that says 50 cents, I see this shiny cassette player, and immediately I'm like, oh my God, it's a Talkboy.
You can have lots of high-tech fun with Tiger's Talkboy tape recorder.
Hey, stop drooling on me.
In 1992, Talkboys were the most popular toy that Christmas, and that's almost entirely due to its appearance in the movie Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
Howdy, Jude. This is Peter McAllister, the father. I'd like a hotel room. Credit card? You got it.
Now, what set the Talkboy apart from just any old Walkman was that it had a slow function that made kids sound like deranged adults.
Plaza Hotel reservations, may I help you?
Howdy, Jude. This is Peter McAllister. The father.
Yes, sir.
I'd like a hotel room.
Yes, sir. You'll need a major credit card upon check-in.
Credit card? You got it.
I'm positive it was on my Christmas list that year, but I never got one. So even though it's a decade-old toy at this point, to me, finding a Talkboy was still a total score. So I hand over 50 cents, get back in the car,
And that's when we notice that there's a tape still within the Talkboy. So Liz puts it on the stereo.
Hello, this is Marcos again. I would like to play another piece called Brodka. Here it is.
So it's a radio show, and this Marcos kid is apparently the DJ. He calls all the songs pieces, and each piece is roughly 30 seconds long.
I would like to play another piece for you. It's called Carlos. Well, now I want to play a piece for you. It is called Go For It. I think I should play another piece for you. It is called Cruising. That was called Clouds. That was one of my favorites. Now here is Cruising. Sorry about that.
And we're just captivated. We're like, why would this adorable child go to all this effort? Who is it for? And where the hell did he get all these songs? And then about 20 minutes in, something crazy happens.
Dakota is Frito, Dakota, Frito, Dakota is a 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 Frito.
So we get it. Dakota is a Frito. But that really only leaves me with more questions, and Marcos gets right back into the show like nothing happened.
Here's a little piece called Upcoming.
After 27 minutes and 39 songs, the show is over. So I get pretty into this tape. I make my brother Evan convert the whole thing into individual MP3s, and I burn a copy for all of my friends. One night at a party, we choreographed an entire dance routine to this song. A few years later, I moved to Seattle, and in the move, I somehow lost the original tape. But I never stopped listening to the MP3s, and I'm always catching myself humming them and dreaming up lyrics. The pieces become ingrained in my very being. So I start looking for the songs online. Google fails me, then SoundHound fails me, Shazam. I get nothing. Not only am I coming up empty on my search for the music, but I also really, really want to find Marcos, and I'm only getting dead ends there too. So as kind of a last resort, I turn to my buddy Alex DeVore. He writes for Santa Fe's weekly newspaper, The Reporter. So I ask if he'd be into doing a story about it, and he is. The Reporter published a one-page story, and Alex even went on the radio to talk about it.
Warren, for 15 years, has been looking for this guy, and now I want to find him too.
Wow.
So we figure if he had the Talkboy, he's got to be early 30s, maybe a little older. Marcos is the name. So if anyone named Marcos or anyone who knows someone named Marcos has information about a Talkboy radio show, we want to find you.
Literally the next day, Alex calls and leaves me a message saying he got an email from someone we'll call Marcos R.
And he says that he did have a Talkboy, which he sold at a yard sale when he got a little older. Just need to verify the address.
Marcos R. emailed me, confirmed that he had a Talkboy, and grew up on the tiny three-block street where the yard sale was. So that was enough evidence for me. But then Alex calls again.
Okay, so we found one guy named Marcos.
But then this morning, Marcos Lujan emails, and he says, oh, I'm the Talkboy, boy.
And this new guy, Marcos Lujan, also had a Talkboy, also grew up on that same tiny street, but he says he knew Dakota. All right, that's enough. Sorry, I won't put you through that again. But here's the other crazy thing. Marcos Lujan knows my brother Evan, the same brother that put the MP3s together years ago, the same brother that knew I was looking for Marcos this whole time.
Evan, how come you didn't tell me you knew someone named Marcos?
I just figured there was no chance that this was the same Marcos. Everyone's named Marcos in New Mexico.
All right, so the only thing left to do was to call him up.
Hello.
Hello, Marcos?
This is Marcos.
I have a million questions for you, but I want to make sure that it's cool that we record them.
Yeah, definitely. I've obviously been comfortable being recorded from a very young age, so yeah, that's cool.
This is like old hat for you.
Exactly.
So you got that's it awesome. Because you saw Home Alone, right?
Yeah, that's exactly why. I think the movie probably came out around Thanksgiving time. I remember seeing it and being like, I have to have that thing.
Who's Dakota?
Dakota was actually my best friend growing up, and he lived down the street. So we would basically walk to school together, and after school just like spend the afternoons hanging out.
Then I asked him about another voice, someone he referred to as a coworker.
There's a voice that interrupts you on the track Intensity.
That's so weird hearing your child voice.
Dad.
Oh, that was my dad. That was totally my dad.
That was my coworker.
My coworker.
So we talked some more about his dad.
I spent a lot of time alone as a kid because I was an only child. And he was talking about how his observation is that I was really creative in how I occupied my free time.
These days, Marcos is a social worker, and he knew my brother because he was dating my brother's really good friend. In fact, he almost came to my wedding.
Isn't that fascinating? We would have met that day.
So it happened. I'm finally able to put a face to this voice. Marcos even sent me a picture of him and Dakota hanging out from the time when they made the tape. But half of what I love about the tape is how great the songs are. So I asked him, where did the music come from?
It must have been like MIDI files, I think, or something on my parents' very first desktop computer.
So I'm still working on finding out who made this music. And Alex from the newspaper is back on the case too. He even went back on the radio in Santa Fe.
So now Warren's trying to find out who composed these songs. They're either Tandy or Windows files. They're called like Africa and Office and Clouds.
While that mystery remains, it's not every day you get to reunite an adult with his childhood self like this. So last, I asked Marcos how he felt about all the effort I put into this.
I dig it. I'm quite jealous that I'm not the one interviewing the person of something that I found. Yeah, it's like a time capsule, a little hidden treasure.
This concludes our little piece collection for tonight. Thank you for joining us. Goodbye.
Bye, Dakota. Sayonara.
That story from producer Warren Langford. That's all for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson, with help this week from Arwen Nix and Hannah Byrne. Thanks also to Warren Langford for his contribution. Our intern is Ginny Palmer. We get web help from Dave Nogueras. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Okay, so I got to tell you about something really cool. Sound Effect is putting on a live show to benefit Save KPLU. It's May 18th at Town Hall in Seattle. It's going to include writer Melanie McFarland, photographer Tim Durkin, songwriter Kimya Dawson, and iconic author Tom Robbins, listening back to some of his 1960s radio recordings. It is going to be amazing, and it'll help keep this station alive and independent. You can find out how to get tickets at our Facebook page. Just search KPLU Sound Effect. We'll be back next week with stories of leaving home.
He said that it's a time release experience, and it will be months and months and possibly years before we really know how we've been changed by going to see. Even that phrase, going to see, it sounds so dramatic, but I mean, that's what it was. It was dramatic.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.